Gomez from Lebanon. She's the author of Dirty Money, a revelatory article on how the largest color revolution attempt in recent Iranian history is led by a woman on Washington's payroll. Welcome to the show. Mona, if I could start with you. Your article was one of the few that highlighted the absence of any evidence that Mahsa Amini was murdered. Tell us what you found out.
I'd like to start this out with how surprised I was with the accessibility of evidence that was present online and how much big media has bombarded us with narratives with no factual basis whatsoever. In an interview by Mahsa Alinejad, basically a CIA asset that works for the U.S. government, an Iranian exile, per se, she openly admits that she is leading the so-called revolution in Iran. So that's how I started out my investigation. Basically, what the article reveals is that she has been operating from an FBI safe house on a payroll over the past 7 years, making over $500,000. Now, for a career in journalism, that is a huge number. And that's in addition to this sort of statement, which is a big statement, which many people have disregarded. CCTV footage shows that Mahsa Amini she suffered a heart attack with absolutely no provocation. What it shows is that the Iranian police comes, approaches her. Perhaps a controversy was going on, a simple back and forth. And then she falls, suffering a heart attack with no physical provocation, at least. And even Mahsa Alinejad, who I've mentioned in the article, had in her personal tweets on her page on Twitter, she made no mention of any physical violence in the first few tweets about Mahsa Amini. But it seems that as the story progressed, all of the sudden, she accuses the Iranian police of waging some sort of violence against her. So this discrepancy in the narrative was very brazen, and I mentioned it in tweets in the article. In addition to that, with that sequence of events, the first news outlets that were to come forward and to accuse Iranian police of killing Mahsa Amini were actually U.S.-funded outlets in Farsi, such as Iran Wire.
Yeah, I just want to ask you, so what's the significance, in your opinion, of Iran to Palestinian resistance factions?
Well, I mean, people must know this, mustn't they? That the Iranians are stalwart supporters of the resistance in Palestine. The term which is used for the unity that there is between various different factions through the whole region is the term the axis of resistance, encompassing the Syrians, Hezbollah in Lebanon, and Sarala in Yemen, and the Iranians are supporting all of that. And if it wasn't for Iran, in terms of supplying weaponry and funding and training, then the possibility of the liberation of Palestine wouldn't even exist.
Sure. I mean, Mona, your article referred to the evolution of the story and the role of certain news outlets like Iran Wire. How are they related to the U.S.?
Well, some of the first news outlets that came to mention or accuse the Iranian police of violence are, for example, Iran Wire and some other, you know, they have their lackeys on social media, because without a base, how will they be able to propagate such a false narrative? So what I looked into and what I found interesting was Iran Wire in particular, because it was founded by Iranian exile Mazyar Bahari. And what I found is that Mazyar Bahari openly admitted to supporting not only illegal demonstrations in Iran, but also color revolutions. And hence why Now he is a Western asset, and he is behind the propagation of such narratives. And many of his likes are doing the same thing. For example, there was one mention of a military writer who works with the Pentagon, and his works are repeatedly cited in papers published by the U.S. military. And these people, they were Iranians. And now they're working for Washington. So you could say that people like Masih Alinejad, people like Mazyar Bahari, they withhold that sort of system in Washington that looks to create instability in West Asia. Mm-hmm. And right now, today, as David mentioned, Iran is a staunch supporter of resistance factions in this area. So to destabilize Iran would be a blow to Palestinian resistance.
Sure. Well, let's just pause there for a moment, if we can, because we've got a report now about the role of the U.S. and Israel, in that matter, in the protests.
You just have to flood a country's public square with enough raw sewage. You just have to raise enough questions, spread enough dirt, plant enough conspiracy theorizing that citizens no longer know what to believe. Once they lose trust in their leaders, in mainstream media, in political institutions, in each other, in the possibility of truth, the game's won.
That was former U.S. President Barack Obama uttering words that, though not specifically about Iran, seems eerily close to describing the West playbook when it comes to fomenting dissent in places like the Islamic Republic. Not coincidentally, the self-proclaimed leader of the protest also lives in the U.S., in an FBI safe house in New York. But who is Masih Alinejad? On Twitter, she has more than 500,000 followers, and more than 8 million on Instagram. But she describes herself on her profiles only as an Iranian journalist and activist, or as a journalist. In reality, Alinejad works directly for a US government propaganda operation called Voice of America. At VOA, she's presented a program for the last 7 years on the VOA's Persian service, and according to public records, has received over $500,000 in government contracts since 2015. In addition to these roles, Alinejad is the founder of two campaigns, White Wednesdays, which encourages the wearing of white headscarves, and My Stealthy Freedom, both claim to be focused on the hijab and women's rights in Iran. But Alinejad is not centrally concerned with reform in Iran, but with increasing sanctions and promoting regime change. She has called for death to the dictator. When she appeared on CNN recently, her remarks were not about the hijab, but about pressuring the U.S. not to make a nuclear deal with Iran and instead increase sanctions.
Stop negotiating with our murderers. Cut off all your ties with the Islamic Republic.
Evidence from inside Iran suggests that, through her and others, the Obama playbook is guiding the protest. Alinejad's views suggest an alignment with extremist Zionist positions. Add to that her links with key Zionist lobby groups in the U.S. In June this year, she received the so-called Moral Courage Award from the Extremist American Jewish Committee, a group with a long record of collaboration with Israeli intelligence. Alinejad was also booked to speak at the conference of United Against Nuclear Iran in September this year. UANI is a hardline US-based group which has a former director of Mossad on its advisory board. Masih Alinejad is one of many vehicles for the US and Israel to undermine the Islamic Republic of Iran, not least because of its steadfast support of the Palestinian liberation movement and the axis of resistance more widely.
Mona, can you tell us what you know about Masih Alinejad's connection to the U.S.?
Yes. So governmental data openly reports that since 2014, when she moved to the U.S., till today, Alinejad has earned about $628,000 from the U.S. Agency for Global Media. The U.S. Agency for Global Media is the most significant regime-changing arm for the U.S. empire, and it's directly funded by the U.S. Congress. Right now, as we are speaking, she's protected by the FBI. Why would she be protected by the FBI if she's doing some form of clean-cut journalism? She's doing a lot more than that. Much of her work on social media is not only a regime change, but it's also sort of whitewashing the images of war criminals. She has images with people like Madeleine Albright and Mike Pompeo, who, to be honest, for the wars that they have waged and for the aggression they have upheld, they should be tried in The Hague, you know? So she is very, very close to Washington, and she is doing their dirty work.
Yeah. I mean, David, what support has Alinejad had from Israel lobby groups?
Oh, well, she's well in with the Zionist movement, especially in the US. I mean, she's had support from AIPAC, the biggest Israel lobby group. She's had support from the American Jewish Committee, which we saw there in the film, a long-standing Zionist organization, which, you know, used to be non-Zionist until about 1945 and then became very Zionist, set up Commentary magazine, the leading neoconservative journal throughout the whole post-war period. So there's that. And, of course, there's the United Against Nuclear Iran connection, but there are also the group Stand With Us, which of course is used by the Ministry of Foreign Affairs in occupied Palestine as a force multiplier, and that's the words of an Israeli minister talking about that. So she's very closely in with it, and she's also expressed her desire to normalize relationships with Israel, to visit Israel, that there shouldn't be a boycott of Israel. So she's very much using the kind of Israeli playbook.
Mm. I mean, given what David has said just there at Mona, I mean, Masih Alinejad has been very favourable, hasn't she, towards the Zionist regime and her public comments. I mean, do you think Israel's role's important here?
Even if no evidence conjures on the internet, it is very much likely that the CIA coordinated with the Mossad. And we have to note here that Israel is the United States' most staunch ally in this region, and its role in West Asia is to create chaos. It lives off of it, and it functions off of it. So even if, which is impossible, even if the Mossad had absolutely no role in what's happening in Iran today, it is benefiting off of it. And here we could look back at a speech by former Prime Minister Netanyahu before Bush's so-called war on terror, where he mentions that part of the strategic destabilization of West Asia is to destabilize Iran, Iran, which is one of the most stable and one of the most sovereign countries in our area, supporting resistance factions. In order to destabilize such an open society to Netanyahu, they would have to create some sort of identity confusion, a soft power. So what he mentioned was, let them watch Hollywood, let them watch films. Today it's Netflix. He suggested Beverly Hills 90210, let the Iranian youth see all that luxury, all those pools, all those mansions, so that they could maintain some sort of cultural superiority. And the fruit of that behavior is it's occurring today. They're bearing it. But not in an organic way. It's been happening over a course of 20 years. So yeah. Israel definitely does have a hand in this, and it is benefiting off of the chaos that it's reaping right now.
No, indeed. I mean, and David, I mean, what can you tell me about the Iranian opposition groups like the supporters of the former Shah and the Mujahideen El-Kak or MEK or MEK organization that was delisted actually as a terror group by the UK in 2009, I believe. I mean, what do you have to say about that?
Well, I mean, it's interesting that the MEK is an armed organization. It's regarded as a terrorist organization by the Iranians and by others. It used to be regarded by both the UK and the US as a terrorist organization. It did this lobbying campaign in 2012. It was delisted in the US. And it's very active still. It has, for example, the Facebook last year attempted to close down a troll farm it operates in Albania, which seems to have been unsuccessful. It continues to be active in the contemporary period. And it's also been active in demonstrations around the world. And in London, for example, there were MEK people in Trafalgar Square, involved in an attack on a mosque where many Iranian exiles, a very strong role there for the MEK, but supporters of the old Shah. And you can see this when you look at the demo. The flag that they have is slightly Iranian flag, but it has a lion and a moon on it, and that's the monarchist flag. And these are people who support the Shah. And in effect, I mean, the symbols on that flag are actually, I mean, extraordinarily enough, actually Aryan symbols.
Good Lord.
And there's an actual right-wing ideology underlying all this, which sees Iranians as being superior ethnically and racially to Arabs. So there's an extraordinary set of politics in there.
Just finally then David, and briefly, because we are running short of time, is it really true that the group known as United Against Nuclear Iran is actually an asset of the Zionist entity?
I would go further than saying it was an asset. I mean, this is a very extreme pro-Zionist organization, which is used to pressure the US government to do what the Israeli government wants. I mean, not just that they had Meir Dagan, the former chief of Mossad, on its advisory board, but it's absolutely stuffed with card-carrying neocons and pro-Zionists. And its function really is to pressure the US to make sure that the US doesn't ever do anything rational and does things that the Israelis want, which is to, you know, effectively to isolate and intimidate and subvert the government of Iran.
Well, unfortunately, we're out of time. Let me thank Mona Issa for joining us from Lebanon, obviously David, our resident expert. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back next week with more news and analysis on Palestine Declassified. So until next time, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
این چیزی که انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا ذکر الله تطمئن می کند.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
Allahu ya Allah subhanallah. Allahu ya Allah walhamdulillah. Allahu wa la ilaha illallah. Allahu ya Allah wallahu akbar.
This is a part of political divine will of the founder of Islamic Republic of Iran, Imam Khomeini. My explanation does not dwell on the transcendental, spiritual, or mystical aspects of Thaghaleyn, nor do I mean to comment on that which has befallen humanity by his negligence of true nature and status of the great trust or precious things, that is, Thiql Akbar, the Holy Quran, and that of the great trust, that is, Thiql Kabir, the progeny of the Prophet, peace be upon him, and his pure progeny, which is greater than anything except Thiql Akbar, which is absolutely great. Nor will this explanation speak of harm that enemies of Allah and the taghutis, oppressors, have done to these Thiqls. For it is impossible for someone like me, with limited knowledge and time, to give an account of all the wrong done to the Thaghaleyn, but taghutis and the enemies of Allah. I only considered it appropriate to summarize the sufferings which these two have endured.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, dear listeners, sisters and brothers from all over the world. You're listening to Spring of the Truth from IRIB English Radio, and this is your humble host, Zainab Mousavi. In this program, we will discuss and elaborate on Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah alayhi's viewpoints in regards to the station of the mother. In one of his speeches about the mother's role in training a proper progeny, Imam Khomeini says that the mother's service to the community is greater than that of the teacher. It is greater than all other services. And again, in another sentence, he emphasizes this great status by saying that the child's first school is the mother's lap. You see that one of the most important responsibilities of the parents, and especially of the mother, is to raise the next generation of faithful Muslims. The fact is that our cultural environment in the modern world has become more materialistic and less moral, and this is undeniable. Imam Khomeini, as the leader of a great nation, as a policyman, as a great religious man, and as a father of a family, had all these views about women. And he gives so much respect to the rank of women, sees them precious. And all these are while the backward societies did not accept women to be precious and significant. And you know, that's quite interesting for me as a researcher and as a lover of Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah alayh. And I wanted to share this view with you, dear listeners, and may Allah protect you all.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You're listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we discuss your problems, questions you have regarding the Islamic upbringing of your children. A child is like a white paper on which you can write good things or bad things. Entire personality of a child is developed by the parents, by the upbringing they do. And in this program, we try to provide all the necessary information that is required to bring up your child in the best possible way. The answers of your questions are based upon Noble Quran and the narrations of Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him, and his purified progeny. Today in our studio, we have had the pleasure to invite Professor Salman Nakavi, who is a faculty member of Al Mustafa University and researcher in the Hausa Ilmiya of Qom. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
A very warm welcome.
Thank you very much.
Well, Professor Nakavi, in a previous episode, you told us many elements, many things an educator and trainer, a parent should have for the upbringing of a child. You said there should be understanding of self, there should be understanding of competencies, there should be skills, there should be attitude. Would want you to throw some more light on the attitude?
Yes, as I said, the most important thing, of course, attitude is embedded in our knowledge.
Yeah.
The attitude which we have or we develop, one root is the knowledge the cognition we have of things.
Yeah.
The other then aspect goes into the emotions and the feelings which emanate from that knowledge and causes those actions and behavior, outward behavior, which is very important in any relationship, especially man and wife, and more so between parents and children.
Yeah.
So the attitude plays a bridging role
Between
the knowledge we have and the skills which have to be employed in that relationship.
You remind me of some lines wherein it says that, look at your thoughts, they become your words. Look at your words, they become your actions. Look at your actions, they become your habits. And look at your habits, it becomes your character.
Very good. Very good. That's exactly what we want to say. So our thoughts, our understanding, number one, apart from those elements that we were talking about, the most important thing is that as a person who is considered to be a true believer, a practicing believer, a mu'min, a salih person, a competent person, the most important feature is that it is for the sake of God. Everything is for the sake of God. Everything is within the bounds of Allah's rules and commands. With a purpose in mind for implementing the concept of Tawheed in society based on wilaya, the implementation of wilaya, as we mentioned before. Parents become a link between the family and the imamah, concept of imamah.
All right.
As they are the
guardians at home,
they are a part of the process of creativity that Allah Almighty has adopted for the creation of the universe and
True.
The human beings.
Mm-hmm.
They are part of that system.
Yeah.
They are within the system of causes and effects that lead to the creation of a human being in this world. So the parents play a role in the creation of the human being as a part of that system. They are not the creators themselves. They facilitate the
All
creation
right.
of a human being
yeah.
and of a child. And the system has been created by Allah Almighty because He is the supreme creator.
Yeah.
And then as they become a part of that system, they also become a part of the concept of wilaya, which has to be, as mentioned before, has to be imbibed in the child.
Mm-hmm.
And they have to have this understanding and this thought in their minds. And this has to change into their attitude, where they are able to bring up a child in this worldview.
Yeah.
And in this ideology.
Yeah.
And that is very important, because upbringing of a child, as I said, as a trust of Allah Almighty, a person who is going to become a part of the companions of the Imam, that is a very important thing. That's a mission which has to be undertaken with a great zeal.
And so it does not happen just it does not happen in one night.
It doesn't happen. Yeah. There's a lot of learning involved.
Yeah.
And even if, as I said, we have these things in our minds, we have a lot of things, but during the whole process, we need to learn.
Yeah. So we are always in the process of learning. We'll talk more on that after a short break. The listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. I'm with Professor Naqafi, and we are discussing parents as educators and what qualities they should have. Well, Professor Naqafi, you said that ultimate aim for now, like the current generation, is to create soldiers for Imam Zaman, Ajallah Ta'ala Faraja. You said that to create soldiers for him, to make an army for him, an army that is always in the state of ready, steady, and go. Now, you said that this does not happen in just one night. It has a lot of process, a lot of learning to go through. So we were focusing on attitude, the element of attitude. I would want to know more from you.
So when we talk about a person who has knowledge, he right. knows, he understands, he has that worldview. We have a very comprehensive worldview. We have a great deal of understanding about the universe, but that does not necessarily change into actions or behavior.
All right.
Until unless the knowledge goes to a level where one has faith.
Okay.
In what he knows and what he believes.
All right.
And faith is at a higher level than knowledge.
All right.
Knowing is maybe believing, but it's not necessarily having faith.
All right. So
faith is something which is much beyond that, which translates into actions by virtue of the taqwa it generates in our attitude.
All right. So we as parents should have this thing in our minds, like if I have a daughter and I only give her the knowledge of hijab, I don't do the things that it becomes her faith that she chooses it herself. Yeah, she's not going to practice it maybe.
Myself also, if I want to be able to educate my child properly, I also have to have the proper faith.
Yeah.
Knowledge, attitude, the faith. The faith has to translate into taqwa. Taqwa is where I should not only say that I believe and have faith in Allah Almighty, I accept His rules, but I am ready to implement them okay. in my life. That's the realm of taqwa. When I become ready to just, you know, I'm on a springboard, ready to take off
yeah.
and dive.
Yeah.
That is where taqwa comes in.
Yeah.
Makes me take care of myself within the bounds of Allah Almighty, the boundaries He has made.
Yeah.
And then I'm ready to create that behavior which is necessary. And
required.
This is the same thing. Huh?
The required behavior.
The required behavior.
Yeah.
And this is how that behavior will be inculcated in my child also.
Exactly. We'll talk more on that after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات.
The Prophet صلى الله عليه وآله وسلم said, honor your children and teach them good manners.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. I'm with Professor Neka. We were discussing what elements educator parents need to be having as educators. Well, Professor Nakavi, you were saying.
Yes, I was saying knowledge, then faith, then taqwa. Then taqwa translates into action and behavior. And that is the stage where one becomes a person called muhsin, who has carried out good deeds in the best possible way. That is ihsan, that is muhsineen. Like we have muttaqeen and muhsineen.
Okay.
Are interrelated.
All right.
So taqwa leads to carrying out good actions, good deeds, amale saleh, with ihsan. Ihsan is doing good deeds in the best possible way with excellence. And that requires proper skills.
Exactly. But don't you think many parents out there who maybe themselves, they are practicing Muslims, they have knowledge, they have everything. But when it comes to their children, they directly start with actions, while as you are saying that action comes at last. The first part is knowledge, and then how it becomes faith, and how it develops into taqwa, and then how your taqwa, you know, actually facilitates your actions. But many parents are out there who are directly working on actions. They don't educate their children. They don't give knowledge about that particular thing. They don't develop that faith regarding that particular thing.
Of course, it's in my analysis, when I analyze these concepts and bring about a relationship between them, this analysis comes forward. But when we are acting, all of these things are embedded within us, in our thoughts and in our feelings, and they should be there. So it's nothing wrong in going to the action stage, but with this background, of course, it's not going to lead to the proper results.
Yeah.
I have to be pretty sure that when I'm dealing with my child, then I am doing with a proper mindset, with a proper attitude, with the proper faith, the sincerity of purpose. It shouldn't be for my sake. My own self. It should be for the sake of Allah. It should be not that I want this child to grow up to take care of me.
Yeah.
I want him to grow up so he becomes a custodian of the heritage of the Islamic tradition.
Yeah.
Me, I'm not important. Yes, if he takes care of me, that's up to him. But I have to create a person. I have to train a person. I have to bring him up in such a way that he becomes a perfect Muslim.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Professor Nakavi, for being with us. Well, dear listeners, nothing comes overnight. There's a lot of job to do, especially when it comes to our children. And in this program, we provide you all that. Thank you so much for being with us. You are listening to IRIB English Radio. In case you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, please contact us at englishradio@irib.ir. You can also find us on social media platforms by just searching Call of Islam Radio or our official website. That's www.parstoday.com. Until another session, fi amanillah. God bless you all.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. Islam solves all of our problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of Allah. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. A way of life, a way of life.
insight.
Welcome to Insight. On this episode, we will be discussing European security polarization and the new Cold War against Russia with Professor Heinz Gärtner from the University of Vienna. But first, this brief analysis.
Decades of aggressive eastward expansion by US-led NATO towards the borders of the Russian Federation following the collapse of the Soviet Union and the aftershocks of the Russian invasion of Ukraine have led to a dramatic security polarization in Europe, not seen since the height of the Cold War in the mid-20th century. The dreams of a borderless Europe from the Ural Mountains to the Atlantic Ocean seem very naive these days, as a hard border is being established between the Russian Federation and neighboring European countries, with a dramatic increase in the level of militarization on both sides, which, if history is to be guide, will not be dismantled very quickly once it's firmly established. Even the previously non-aligned countries of Sweden and Finland have joined NATO. It seems the old British plan of preventing a strategic alignment between Russia and Europe, and particularly between Russia and Germany, is once again being implemented. However, this time this effort is being led by Britain's American cousins, who inherited the British Empire following World War II. It's precisely in the period of the so-called American unipolar moment in the late 1990s and early 21st century, where the world witnessed the aggressive expansion of NATO towards the western borders of Russia. The instrumentalization of Ukraine, the weaponization of Ukrainian nationalism against Russia and Russian speakers in Ukraine, and the threat of Ukrainian NATO membership was the final straw and repeatedly stated red line that pushed Russia to take preemptive military action against NATO expansion into Ukraine. The severe reactions and sanctions by the Western countries against Russia have led Russia to strategically reorient itself towards the east and southeast, towards China and Iran. This has been very beneficial for Eurasian integration and particularly for boosting Iran-Russia relations, and it represents a very significant historic and geostrategic shift. But the question remains whether it's in the national interests of European countries to have bad political and economic relations with Russia. Is it really in the interests of many European nations to sanction and vilify their most important energy and raw material supplier and one of their largest export markets? Despite historically high inflation, the threat of closure of major industries, and exponential rises in energy costs, brainwashed Atlanticist European elites continue to repeat the anti-Russian propaganda designed in US and NATO think tanks, contrary to what many of the citizens believe, which is neutrality and non-alignment based on the real, tangible interests of nations. Of course, the people of Europe have so far received their reply from their elites. As for example, when the young, inexperienced German foreign minister proudly announced that helping Ukraine is more important than what German voters want. It remains to be seen how she and her party will fare the next time German voters get to vote on what they want. Cracks are already appearing in the European facade as nations such as Hungary and Serbia are trying to take an independent position based on their national interests vis-a-vis Russia, as well as countries such as Austria, who are warning about the consequences of unilateral energy sanctions and trying to moderate the anti-Russian rhetoric. But in general, it seems that nearly all European elites have once again shown their geopolitical impotence and inability to form policies independent from US and NATO diktats. As we head into this year's cold winter in Europe, we will have to see how much the European people are willing to sacrifice from their high standards of living in the pursuit of this new Cold War against Russia, which has divided Europe and forced a major historic and geopolitical realignment in the world, and which, contrary to US and NATO propaganda, does not appear to be in Europe's long-term interests.
Professor Heinz Gärtner, Professor of Political Science, University of Vienna. Thank you so much for joining us on Insight.
You're welcome.
When we heard that you're coming to Tehran, we asked you to come join us in person for this interview. You kindly replied to this request, so here we are. We want to talk, as you know, the program Insight is really a program where we try to look at things strategically. We try to get a deeper understanding of what's going on. And one of the major issues of the world today is what the events that are happening in Europe, particularly the events that have now occurred with the war in Ukraine. And it seems that there is a new security architecture, a new security structure, a new reality that has descended upon Europe, a reality which in many ways is very similar to the Cold War. You have this hard border again being drawn between Europe and Russia. You have countries that even during the Cold War, like Finland and Sweden, who weren't part of NATO, are joining NATO. But here we have to then look at really again this bad faith that we see from the West and from the Americans, which is so you have this Ukraine after the Soviet Union, which has a significant Russian speaking population, culturally Russian population, and then they do the Maidan coup. They bring in these neo-Nazi groupings that are part of this coalition. We don't want to say that they were the main people, but they were a significant part. And you change the constitution. They get rid of the Russian language as part of the constitutional rights of the Russian people. You have the civil war starting in 2014. So, yes, I mean, your point is well taken that that this would have been a good situation. But it seems to me that the last thing that the Americans or NATO wanted is a Ukraine where people are living together in peace. They actually were provoking the Russians in many ways. With the attacks that they did particularly on the Russian population. And then when the NATO membership was mentioned, again, we are trying to analyze. We're not trying to justify or to agree or disagree with whatever decision was made in Russia. But it is understandable from an analytical perspective if the Russians felt like there was no other option left for them, because they tried all the political options. And it seemed, whether it was the Minsk agreements, whatever, all the other political and diplomatic formulas and ways to deal with this, they saw it was not happening. And maybe this is something going back to the essence of Ukraine. You have this country being created, as you mentioned, and Henry Kissinger mentioned a long time ago, that you have actually two
March
Ukraines.
2014.
Exactly. That you have actually two Ukraines. It's not one country. You have this Ukraine in the West, which is Catholic and much more culturally closer to Poland and that part of Europe. And then you have the East, which is culturally closer to Russia. So what I want to say, because you mentioned these very interesting things. So what you're saying is that essentially we've had this historic turn, this historic event happening, where Russia is separated from Europe, where it separated itself, if we want to analyze it from that perspective, or the Europeans decided with the Americans to separate themselves from the Russians. In Iran, of course, we would say that this was good for us, because then Russia came towards the Asian side, came closer to China, became closer to Iran. As we see, there's very extensive an increase of relations between Iran and Russia in this time. So maybe geopolitically for Asia or Eurasia, this was better. But again, my question is it really in the national interests of a lot of these European countries to have this cordon sanitaire, this hard border? If you look at Hungary, it's trying to have some sort of an independent policy with Russia. It's not, in terms of at least rhetorically and in terms of the way they speak, they are being a little bit more cautious in terms of their relation with Russia. You see even Austria, in many ways, trying to maintain its neutrality within this idea of what's going on, this alliance building, as you say. We see, of course, Serbia, traditionally a natural ally of the Russians, culturally close to the Russians, basically saying that they will not join NATO, no matter what. So again, my question is, as a European, I'm asking you, is it really in many of these countries, particularly those who are closer to Russia, who are maybe dependent in terms of energy and gas and coal and raw materials? Is it really in their interest to be in a Cold War and a kind of a non-relation state with Russia?
Let me make two points. First point, briefly. I don't think we have that much time anymore.
No, go ahead.
So, to Ukraine. I have to say, Russia was not really fond of neutrality either. So Russia said that I would be in, that would support a non-NATO membership of NATO, which is was credible, I would think. Every Russian president repeated that. But they did not really speak about neutrality. They didn't really. So that because that meant the Russian supported militias in the east.
Right. That means Russia would also have to.
Well, Russia would have. It would be an example also for Moldova and Georgia, where you have Russian troops or peacekeepers. Right. Either. Right. So it would be a model for others as well. So the Russians would not really support neutrality. And I have to say, if Ukraine would have become neutral, it could get its territorial sovereignty and territorial integrity back. So it's a unified, right. you mentioned it's divided. The Russians might have speculated that they want somehow keep the eastern part.
Right.
But if there would be a neutral, would have been a neutral Ukraine, all foreign powers would have to leave, and Ukraine would have the possibility, like Austria, to create its own identity. Right. Sovereignty.
In other words, nobody wanted a neutral Ukraine, neither NATO and neither
unfortunately
Russia.
Unfortunately, you're right.
Exactly.
Some supported it, so right. like Henry Kissinger, Mearsheimer as well. They came later as well with the suggestion. So there are some pundits who really thought that it might be the best. But politically, you're correct. Politically, you're correct. So your second point, do the Europeans really want to have this divided Europe? So, and I have to say no. So
exactly.
Because now Putin brought war, and Putin and NATO brought the division of Europe back, like in the Cold War, but that was our starting point. Now it plays out like in this polarization, we have a division of Europe, cordon sanitaire. It even goes to the cultural level. So
it's ridiculous. Some of the sanctions are ridiculous. Sports, culture, opera singers,
arts, science.
It's ridiculous.
To talk to Russian
scientists. We were joking in Iran that it's even worse than the sanctions against Iran, which we thought would never happen.
I don't know whether I could speak on Russian TV like I speak here. So we have this new coordinator on there, and it will last decades. And the Europeans cannot want to have this.
Exactly.
So they have to think about it, maybe not immediately, but we do have concepts from the history which it could be applied.
So let's talk about that a little.
So I just mentioned two of them.
Right.
So one is because I'm coming from Vienna. We had the Vienna Congress of 1815. Exactly. We had the Napoleonic Wars, and then the victory powers would sit together, and they would ask France to come to the table a little bit later on as well, and created an order for Europe, which was peaceful first half a century, and then we had this wars of unification, another Crimean war, but then it lasted another half century under the first war. So it was based on balance of power, at the same time on liberal concepts, common values. I have to say, there were all colonial powers. So their interventions in the south, that was permitted.
Exactly. That was the
caveat of this.
Exactly.
But for Europe, it was not such a bad concept to sit together and to avoid another war, which was successful, at least half a century, you can say.
Right.
Then you had this war. So Europeans would think about it. Is this type applicable to have a big conference when the war is over, to think about it? You have to somehow bring in Russia back to Europe.
Right.
Like Europe did it after the Second World War with the Marshall Plan. After the First World War, they isolated Germany. And
didn't work.
The result was Hitler.
Exactly.
The Nazis, no?
Exactly. So after World War II, they had the Marshall Plan
And then the second concept I would like to mention is during the height of the Cold War, we had the Conference on Security and Cooperation, the Helsinki Accords of 75. And this was an interesting concept. height of the Cold War, we had the arms race, of course. We had, at the same time, the German Ostpolitik and also the Downpolitik by President Nixon. It was all a global context,
exactly.
Of course. But
exactly.
it was the Helsinki Conference. And if you look at the Helsinki documents, they do not mention the words enemy, foe, competitor, rival. Right. If you look at the security strategies right now,
yeah,
they're all full of the
exactly.
all full of this. And why? And it speaks about common security, cooperative security. And why is it interesting theoretically? So we talked about the security dilemma before. Because security, if we make a decision, security, the other one would react somehow. That would be, I increase my security, and the other would feel
right.
it offensive. And so the idea was not to increase the security, but to lower the threat level.
Exactly.
A common security is the opposite of the security dilemma.
Right.
Common security was also the idea of the Palme Commission later
right,
on.
Right.
Willy Brandt, Palme, Kreisky, so they had this,
yes.
This idea.
Yes.
So this lower the threat and not increase my military capacity.
And they were all social democrats. Olaf Palme, Willy Brandt, Bruno Kreisky.
Yeah. I have to mention this. The one who really prevented the neutral Central Europe in the 50s, according to the Austrian model, there were ideas, Western pundits, not just Stalin. So it was George Kennan as well.
Mm-hmm.
It was Labour Party leader Hugh Gaitskell. It was the bipartisan initiative, Noland Humphrey from the US. They all said, Rapacki Plan, Polish foreign minister, they wanted to create a neutral Central Europe, a nuclear weapon-free,
right.
With the inclusion of Germany. Germany would be unified, but it was also Czechoslovakia, Poland, Hungary would not part of the Warsaw Pact. So the one who really was opposed it was Konrad Adenauer.
Right.
But I have to say, the father of Austrian neutrality was also a conservative. It was Julius Raab. So
genau.
There
exactly.
was a conflict between Adenauer and Raab. So I had to mention this because you said there
yes,
were
some
social democrats.
Maybe we can do a program on Austria one day.
No. I know. The time is
no, that would be interesting one. We should do it one day.
But I said,
yes.
Europe, let me summarize, Europe have to think about concepts which go beyond this division. Otherwise, we will have this conflict
exactly.
on sanitaire.
But it seems to me the atmosphere, the public atmosphere, it really is not conductive right now. Any politician who would even mention these things right now, they would, you know, they would hang him up, you know.
That's definitely...
This is a problem, isn't it? I mean, we have a situation where you had this massive propaganda campaign, you know, and it's interesting to me because, you know, Europeans in general, on the average, are much more, you know, conscious, aware, educated, have more information about the world than maybe American public has. So maybe one can understand if the Americans want to, you know, apply this propaganda to their own population because their own population is very ignorant about the world. But the Europeans don't seem to be, are not that ignorant. And yet we see this massive propaganda campaign still going on. The idea that somebody would come out and say, look, we need to talk to the Russians at some point. This is not in our favor. It seems to me this is almost an impossible thing to propose right now as a political figure or as a public figure.
Unfortunately, yes. But it might change if Europe will feel the effects of the war and if you they will learn about the casualties. So they're not different than Americans. If you see casualties all the time and refugees and... So it over time, if a war goes on for too long, it might change the attitude. But on a global level, because you talk about the European citizens, now we have this war situation, which is a very special situation. And in a war, you have always this with me or against me. You have this
dichotomy.
So there is no place for a complex, as we did, complex analysis.
So we have to start.
Right. But let's just mention one thing that was an... poll by the European Council on Foreign Relations, which was taken before the war already. But the question was, if there is a conflict between US mm-hmm. and China, It didn't even ask military conflict. It only said conflict.
Right.
What options would you choose? Go with China, go the way, with,